group stages of the World Cup is coming to the end. Can Ireland learn anything from the different teams on show? A lot of technical teams involved indeed. A team of technicians, as Bosnia were described. This is the Why Big Football Show on Freak FM. I'm Dave O'Grady. To get in contact with the show, you can tweet at FRQFM and you can check out the Freak FM Facebook page. Coming up, I'm going to be talking to James Carew of Pogue McGull about the fantastic new magazine that those guys have. They're going global from an Irish football website to a world football magazine. Pogue McGull is going from strength to strength. We'll also be going down under with Gareth Morgan talking about the Irish in Australia, and Damien Duff making his big move to Melbourne City. We'll be looking at the opportunities there and the competitiveness of the league over there. But first, it has to be about the Irish women's team. A fantastic performance, earning a draw away to Russia, one of the powerhouses of ladies football. I'm delighted to be joined by Irish soccer sensation Karen Duggan. Karen, a terrific result to come away from Russia with a point. We know what happened earlier when we played them in Tala, but you girls must be very much thrilled with being able to frustrate the Russians. Goalkeeper Emma Byrne, of course, kept them at bay with a couple of important stops.
Yeah, Emma had an absolutely outstanding performance, and coming off the back of a 3-1 home defeat, if someone had told you before the game that you'd hold Russia to a nil-all draw away from home, you'd be absolutely over the moon. But we actually felt like we could have nicked it on the day. That's how good of a performance we put in. But it's absolutely brilliant progress coming from the back of that defeat at home to go over to Russia and do what we did there. So yeah, I suppose when you look back on it now, we will be quite happy when we reflect on where we came from to where we got to.
In those type of games, Karen, do you think confidence maybe builds as the longer it goes, and you can see how the frustration of the Russian players, of course they were expecting to not maybe brush you guys aside, but almost have a comfortable enough victory going on what happened before. But as the game goes on, we know Emma's made a couple of important saves at the end of either half. Was the confidence there? Do you feel like as the game goes on towards the end, you think, yes, this is going to be our day?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what actually killed us at home, is that we gave away two goals and so early on in such quick succession. We felt like going into the game, you know, first half, just hold them out. We did that, and we actually had the better chance of the first half. Same in the second half, we felt like we should have had a couple of penalties and there was no way that they were getting through. So I think the confidence was building the whole way throughout the match, and the longer it goes on, the longer you think, right, we could actually get a result here. So yeah, definitely the confidence did stem from keeping them out for that long.
You mentioned the Russia game where we were beaten 3-1 at home in Tala earlier in the campaign, and as you said, there was two goals scored there within the first 10 minutes. If you contrast this, also comparing that with the Germany game where, you know, conceding maybe goals that really didn't need to be, is it fair to say that there's been so many lessons learned throughout this campaign and it was reflective in your performance against Russia?
Definitely, you know, you're always going to learn from mistakes like that. You know, we were so disheartened after the Russia performance because we know we didn't do ourselves justice. Against Germany, we weren't expected to get much from the game, but we felt we could have again in that game. So it was disappointing in the end to not even get a draw out of that one. But definitely the result against Russia, we had to learn from that. There was no way we could go out and afford to make the same mistake, especially on their home turf, like they would have ripped us apart. So the game plan changed a bit, and luckily we stuck to it and stuck to our guns and held them out and put in a good performance. So I think it was important for us to put in a performance like that.
And as you said, a real chance, you know, to perhaps nick the game. I know Ireland's best chance probably came to Fiona O'Sullivan at the stroke of half-time, as you said, Karen. Denied by the Russian keeper, it could have been a different story altogether.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it would have been a perfect time to score as well. Would have really knocked them back a bit just before half-time. I actually think Fiona connected with it too well, and the Russian keeper pulled off an outstanding save. Like, you have to give her credit. But yeah, you go in 1-0 up at half-time, I think they might have started to panic even, and we could have gone forward. But again, we could have nicked it in the second half as well. We had a couple of chances, but it wasn't to be on the day. But a nil-all result. Still good.
It is indeed. Now, we remain 5 points adrift of second place, the opponents in second place. I think 3 games left to play. We know runaway leaders Germany, they've already booked their place in next summer's finals in Canada. But there's still a good chance for you girls to qualify, providing the remaining results go our way. that must be, you know, a lot of a bit of a motivation among the team, you know, to compete right in there till the end.
Absolutely, yeah. We're definitely going out to get maximum points, and we have to be realistic going away to Germany. They are the outright leaders of the group, but we're going to go out and do our best in the last three games, certainly be looking for six, if not more points from that. And you never know, there could be a shock left in the campaign. You know, Croatia, not a bad side, so they could throw a spanner in the works. So there's a lot of football left to be played, so we'll keep our fingers crossed till then anyway.
Croatia, certainly not a bottom seeded side as they had been coming into the group, which was remarkable. How difficult of a campaign has it been for the girls, Karen, with the locations that you've had to travel to? It's the type of group, when the draw was made, that you guys wouldn't have wanted, you know, a lot of travelling. But having said that, you've seemed to have grown in confidence, and this Irish team, they're not afraid to go away from home.
No, I don't think that we're really intimidated by going anywhere now. It's just part of it now. A lot of the girls even play abroad and stuff, so we're used to travelling, and you prepare the same at home as the way you're always going out to do things as professionally as you can. So we take each game as it comes and prepare for it as well as we can, no matter where it is.
Indeed. Just before I let you go, we had Dora Gorman on the show last week, Karen, and she made the point that there was such a good mix in this Irish team. As you said, there's some girls that are playing away from home and abroad and that, and then there's girls like yourself from Kilkenny, I think, and mixing it up with you know, girls from all over Ireland and that and far beyond. It must be, the team has developed almost into a kind of a club atmosphere, I'd say, and such good relationships building all the time. And maybe we're starting to see that in the team's performance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the more we play against each other in the National League and play with each other, and we're getting to know each other better all the time. And when we come in for training camps, we're in there for a few days. So there's good camaraderie among the squad. And yeah, there's a brilliant mix, like, of people from all over, different ages as well. So there's a good blend of youth and experience and everything in it. So yeah, it definitely is. It's always helping that you know, you get on well with people, you're going to work harder for those people. So yeah, it's a really nice atmosphere in the camp anyway.
Well, Karen, thanks a million for joining us. Many, many congratulations on what was a terrific result out in Russia, and continued success with this team. I know after the Croatia victory, the confidence spread throughout the girls, and you've certainly done your country proud. Thanks a million for joining us.
No worries, thanks for having me.
Turn it up.
Go, go, go. Freak FM is brought to you by AIB,
the future project.
Tweet us your request and your song could be next.
Whatever the future brings.
Bring it on.
Well, Damien Duff pulled off a surprise with his move to Melbourne City. Fantastic stuff altogether. It's really interesting. I'm delighted to be joined by freelance journalist specialising in A-League football, Gareth Morgan. Thanks for joining us on the programme. Damien Duff going to play football in Australia. Firstly, Gareth, is it a shock to people? And secondly, what can he expect?
Well, I think it's I'm not sure how much of a shock it is, given that the whole sort of Melbourne City phenomenon has kind of shaken up the A-League in lots of different ways. As you may be aware, the owners of Manchester City and New York City as well have come in and added what was Melbourne Heart to their sort of collection of clubs. So in many ways, you know, the old rule book of the A-League has kind of gone out of the window. You've got these nouveau riche individuals, I guess you'd call them, on the block. So they're being linked with all sorts of players. We've seen David Villa sign. He signed a couple of weeks before Damien Duff, although I should stress that is just on a guest stint for 10 games, whereas Duff has signed a one-year contract. So it's not really a shock anymore, I suppose, because really the whole nature of the footballing landscape in Australia in some ways has been altered by the takeover and the change of Melbourne Heart to Melbourne City.
You've talked about that change and the, you know, big plush businessmen adding it to their collection, almost like toys for boys, we'll say, Gareth. But is that good for Australian football?
Well, it's a difficult one. It's a difficult one to say whether it's good for Australian football. It certainly increased the interest. It certainly upped the ante, as it were. I mean, it is a controlled league, much in the way that Major League Soccer is controlled, in the sense there is a salary cap and a limit on the number of foreign players we've discussed before on the show, and marquee players and that kind of thing. So there are controls there. It's not as if You can do a Manchester City, as it were, and come in and just throw millions and millions and millions of pounds or dollars, as the case may be, and secure yourself a place at the very top of the tree in that regard. At a personal level, I'm not particularly comfortable with one group owning lots of different clubs around the world. I know we've got the Pozzo family, of course, who are involved at Udinese and Granada and Watford as well. So it's not a new model. It leaves me a little bit uncomfortable at a lot of different levels. But I don't think it'll alter the fabric of the A-League too much. There might just be the odd tweak here and there, but it's certainly a very interesting development. As I said, it's certainly brought a lot of mainstream media coverage the A-League's way during the off-season, which can be very, very quiet in Australia.
And Damien Duff, Gareth, he has obviously had his injuries there at Fulham, and he was in and out of the team, you know, picking up games when he could. But how do you think he's going to do playing in Australia? How competitive will it be? Of course, when Robbie Keane went to LA Galaxy, we initially thought that, okay, it's to see out his career and relax a little bit. But Robbie Keane surprised us all, as he did go there to play and has really made it for himself over there. Can you see something similar happening with Damien Duff?
Yeah, I'd like to think if he can stay injury free, I think he'll be a big success. I think he'll find it very competitive. It is, it is a competitive league. Obviously, you'll find the weather conditions a challenge. It is a league that plays through the Australian summer, so obviously that will come as something of a shock for Damien Duff. But he certainly won't find it easy. There's some very good players. It's a rapidly improving league. I think he's helped by the fact that he's a midfielder as opposed to someone like David Villa, who will of course be depending on service, whereas Damien Duff can kind of take a game by the scruff of the neck and dominate himself. He won't be relying so much on possession being fed into him as Villa will, and I think he'll be very good. I think he'll be a good signing, and he's certainly joined a club that is going places at a very interesting time in terms of Australian football, both at a domestic and I think at an international level.
There's a lot of Irish already over in Australia, Gareth, having moved out or gone on quite a long extended holiday, we can probably say. They're going to get to see him, and that'll be good for Damien to have a lot of Irish fans maybe take an interest, and you know, it's a boost for them to be able to go, and it might develop the club even more.
Well, absolutely, and we've now got an increase in Irish influence. Of course, Sir Liam Miller is at Brisbane Roar. We discussed Andy Keogh heading to Perth Glory as well. He'll be, he's already over there. He's just started pre-season with the WA club. So there's a definite, a gradual increase in the Irish interest in the A-League. And as you said, I'm sure a lot of Irish people who are over there will take in a game if they possibly can. There are also rumours that a certain Mr. Totti might be heading to Melbourne City as well. There's a huge Italian population, of course, in Melbourne. So that could stimulate a great deal of local interest as well.
You mentioned about the salary cap, Gareth, and, you know, they're doing things that are similar to that of the MLS, where, you know, they can buy a certain amount of, you know, big name players and pay them high wages or that. But do you think what's happening now in A-League football is good for the progression of young Australian soccer players coming up, the young Socceroos? We've seen them. We're going to be talking about Australia's performance in the World Cup shortly, but we've seen young good players come up, and they have left Australia as soon as they get a bit of form, to be frank, let's be honest. But is this a good thing for the development of Australian players?
Well, I think it is, because FFA have left in a series of safeguards in terms of squad numbers of Australian players under the age of 21 that have to be included in the squad. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be playing on any given match day, but they are conscious, as a football association, very conscious of not creating a league that is stocked with imports. They are, you know, very aware that they are still developing as a footballing country, and that they do need to make sure that there is a platform for their fine young players to come through and develop and move on to bigger and better things. So although there have been one or two concerns raised, especially with the way Melbourne City, they seem to have managed to get Damien Duff in under the salary cap. Villa obviously is outside that because he comes in as a guest player, but there are then the suggestion that Totti could come in as well. And all of a sudden you've got a team that from the outside looks as if it might have kind of tilted the financial balance, even though technically they haven't. that could be the perception there. But overall, I'd say that there are still enough safeguards in place to make sure that young Australian players do have a pathway to professional football in their own country.
Garrett, what do you think goes through a player's head when they make a decision to go and play in the A-League? I've been thinking about it similar to that of the MLS, the showbiz element, you know, oh, a big player like David Beckham are coming over. They seem to do it towards the end of their careers, we can say. It's, you know, that's a fair statement. And you do get a big name. You were talking about the rumours of Francesco Totti linked with Melbourne City as well. And there's been big names in there. Obviously, Del Piero played and Heskey and Kuhl came back. But is it the showbiz element that's attractive to them, or is it the fact that they still get to play in front of big crowds? Because we see the stadiums do be pretty full, and there's more people coming, and they have passionate fans, particularly like you can see it in the MLS when there's a big rival game on. It's a great atmosphere.
That was an interesting question, but I actually think for many of the players, many of the marquee players, as they're called, that come over, it's almost the complete opposite. It's almost the anonymity that they can enjoy in Australia that appeals to them, having been under the microscope for, you know, whether it's 10 or 15 or even, you know, 20 years in their home country. You've got to bear in mind that a lot of these players, they can wander around most of Australia with probably 75% of the population not recognizing who they actually are. And I know, having spoken to a couple of them, that they do actually find that quite refreshing, the lack of hassle, the lack of tabloid intrusion into their private lives. And of course, the country itself is a massive attraction, is a fantastic lifestyle, which I'm sure Damien Duff will enjoy, and he will be able to enjoy living in Melbourne as, you know, as a pretty regular
guy.
Well, yeah, pretty as much as, you know, pretty much so. He will, because he certainly won't be being mobbed and hounded everywhere that he goes, and I think a lot of them do find that quite refreshing.
You've touched on something there for me, Gareth. I watched a recent documentary with George Best. They were profiling the career of George Best, and he was talking about his time when he went over to America and he was playing over there. And one of the great things that he did say was the fact that he had that anonymity, and the fact that he couldn't, you know, he wasn't mobbed all the time. There wasn't press hounding at his door. He could walk, go down to the shops, you know, meet up with people. And he said he made so many friends over in the States because they knew him for being George and not for George Best, the footballer. They actually got to know him for his actual personality more so than the fact that he had been a huge, successful footballer. That must be very appealing, that element, to meet new people on a kind of a level term, a level playing field, as to pardon the pun.
No, absolutely. I think they can. They can meet people on without any sort of hidden agendas. And I think the other thing is that Australians have that tradition of being no respecters of reputation. And certainly when marquee players come into football clubs, if there is any initial, you know, that they're treated, they're not treated any differently, that's for sure. They do have to muck in. They're expected to do everything that all the other players do. And I think, you know, 9 times out of 10 that the players, the marquee players themselves, they thoroughly enjoy that. They enjoy the fact that they are just treated the same as everybody else, and that's something that they absolutely relish.
There's a couple of other players that might be making the move across to the Premier League. I hear Matt Ryan, he's been touted as the new Mark Schwarzer. That would be a huge move, and no doubt if he was to have an inch of that success, no doubt a lot of clubs will be paying big bucks.
Well, this is it. Now, unfortunately for Matt Ryan, he did drop a bit of a clanger against the Dutch. He certainly should have kept out one of the goals that flew past him. But that little blooper aside, he was voted Belgium's top keeper last season. He's playing over there for Club Bruges. He came through the A-League at Central Coast and developed into an exceptional keeper. Still very, very young, Matt Ryan, but really, you know, already seemingly at the top of his game. And I know that several Premier League clubs have already had a look at him. A number of Championship sides are said to be interested as well. I believe that Celtic have had a look. So Matt Ryan is certainly on the radar of a number of UK clubs, and he looks to have all the requirements to really succeed at either Championship or Premier League level.
Yeah, it seems to be there's a terrific you know, history of good Australian keepers coming through. And it's something that's similar with the USA, where they might not have the fantastic technical ability of players outfield. It's always been one area that they've always been strong. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's an interesting question. Again, there are a number of theories that have been put around about this, whether it's to do with the fact that there are a lot of hand sports played in Australia, similar to the States, of course, with NFL and so on. So there's a lot of sort of hand-eye-ball coordination. I also think as well that it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. When you have a player like Mark Bosnich, for example, who was a real trailblazer for Australian football, Australian kids see, you know, one of their own achieving success abroad as a goalkeeper. The goalkeeping position becomes, you know, a popular one to try and imitate their hero. The same then Mark Schwarzer takes up, you know, the mantle, so they've got another role model to look up to. So I think in many ways it sort of continues almost like a conveyor belt in that respect.
Yeah. I hear Tim Cahill is being strongly linked with Sydney FC. I don't know how true the rumours are, but it would be a fitting tribute for him, no doubt, to finish his career, which most likely it would be, back in Australia.
Well, I think it would be fantastic for Tim Cahill to come back. I mean, I think we've seen from the World Cup, unfortunately, he was suspended for the final group game, but his performance against Holland, playing as an out-and-out centre-forward, which we, of course, know isn't perhaps his natural position, but he's still got a lot to offer. I'm not sure whether some Everton fans weren't looking at that and thinking that they should have perhaps held on to Tim for another year or two, but he's still a player capable of turning a game on its head. I wouldn't be surprised if he takes out the goal of the tournament with that strike, that volley against Holland, an exceptional goal. It would be fantastic for the A-League if he were to come back and have a swan song of a couple of seasons down under. I think the whole footballing public in Australia would be absolutely thrilled to see Tim back.
They've been in a horrible group in the World Cup, let's be honest, Gareth. I mean, they are the team that everybody touted to finish bottom, lucky to score a goal, but you have to say they've tried and they've battled and they've, you know, really played till the end of every game. You know, it's something that seems to be with this Australian team. We've seen it back in South Africa as well. You know, they really, really do try, and it was it's disappointing that they were in such a tough group, because maybe if they didn't have the quality of the teams in there, like, well, Spain, you know, the Dutch and Chile, I mean, it might have gone better for them.
Well, absolutely. And you do have to bear in mind that this is very much an Australian team in transition. They've had a whole clutch of senior players who have hung up their boots or been gradually phased out all at the same time. Harry Kewell, we mentioned a moment or two ago. Lucas Neal is another one. Mark Schwarzer, of course. All come to the end of their international careers at once. So, as I said, it's quite a youthful squad. It's a pretty inexperienced squad, and they have performed extremely well. They came with virtually no expectations whatsoever. They're the lowest ranked team participating in the tournament. They froze in the headlights, unfortunately, in the first 15 minutes of the game against Chile, found themselves 2-0 down. But as you mentioned, they showed great character to battle their way back into the game. Should certainly have had a point out of that first, that opening fixture. It wasn't a 3-1 scoreline, that third goal flying in injury time, just to add insult to injury. And then we all saw in the game against Holland, again, how on earth they didn't emerge with at least a point from that game. And you have to admire the way they went about their business as well. They didn't park the bus against Holland. They really went for it. I think that suits the way that Australia tend to play. It suits the sort of spirit of the country, if you like, the have-a-go spirit. They certainly showed that against Holland in that second game. And they can take a lot of positives out of the tournament. They have the Asian Cup. They're hosting the Asian Cup early next year, 2015, which is a pretty big deal for Australian football, and you'd have to think that they'll show very, very strongly at that tournament. You would expect them to make the final and quite possibly win that. They've got a good group of players coming through. They're perhaps not a huge amount in the striking department, but other areas they're pretty well served. And I think overall, even though they might well come through the World Cup tournament without winning a single game, I think they can certainly head home with their heads held high.
They can indeed. And perhaps delivering one of the most poignant moments of the World Cup when we've seen Bresciano kneeling down and tying the laces of a young mascot who was in crutches, who wasn't able to. A very nice moment there for him and for the Australian team. Certainly reflects nicely on the tournament as a whole.
Absolutely, as you said, it really was one of those moments that will probably be replayed when they do one of those haunting video montages when the tournament comes to an end and we're all a little bit sad that that whole month of madness has ended and we're going to actually have to watch something else on TV. But it was a nice moment, definitely.
It was indeed. Just a final point before you go, Gareth. You mentioned the Asian Cup there coming to Australia, and Australia have been playing now amongst the Asian teams, and it's been better for them because they've been able to play more competitive games. I think they used to just play one playoff and for the chance to go to the World Cup, because in the old Australasia oceanic kind of area, they were hammering teams 32-0 and stuff like that, and it wasn't ideal. That's been a key thing for Australia, getting more competitive games, and having the Asia Cup there will certainly be another chance to improve.
Oh, it certainly has. It's been a massive plus for Australian football, as you rightly mentioned. The Oceania route that New Zealand now go down usually consists of dishing out some hide-ins to the likes of Tahiti and the Cook Islands. So on, and then unfortunately coming up against one of the teams that has just missed out from South America generally tends to be Uruguay. New Zealand came up against Mexico in the most recent playoff for this World Cup. So that was an odd route. You know, it was a very easy route in some respects until it actually came to the crunch game, and then it was very difficult. You'd have to say the Asian route is probably generally more challenging. They do have some big old tough away trips to, you know, the likes of Uzbekistan, and they head to the Middle East a lot to play Oman and Qatar and so on in what are very testing conditions, as I'm sure we'll all find out in a few years' time.
Well, we may or may not.
Well, yeah, exactly. Who knows? But I think the other thing, the other benefit, the other side benefit, as it were, for Australian football is that those games against Japan and China and Korea, they've really put a lot of Australian players into the shop window, and you now have a lot of Australian players heading from the A-League to the J-League or playing in China or in the K-League. So yeah, obviously, again, that's a good level of competition for those players to be improving themselves.
Yeah, no, certainly onwards and upwards for Australian football, and I think that was a huge plus in terms of the development. Gareth Morgan, thanks a million for bringing this terrific international feel to the Why Big Football show, and no doubt we'll be chatting to you again very, very soon.
Thanks very much, Dave. Pleasure speaking to you.
Get with the times. We're online and we're in your pocket. Just search for frq.fm and boom! There we are. Simples.
What started as an Irish football website is now a worldwide magazine. Pogmagol, the place to be. I'm delighted to be joined by James Carew. James, we've featured Pogmagol quite a bit on the Why Big Football show, but having said that, you guys are expanding all the time. The new magazine is out, and one of the great things is you're getting contributions from around the world, and you've built up a great reputation. A lot of bloggers that have been, you know, out there are all of a sudden blogging for Pogmagol.
Hi, Dave. Yeah, that's true. It's really, as you said, it started out as a blog, and really because having myself worked and lived in the UK, there seems to be this kind of blogging culture there, which is about people finding their own interest and putting it out online and finding people with mutual interests and taking it from there. And what ours initially started out really focused on the Irish team, but just over time, it's expanded to cover little bits of everything, and we've made contacts with people, as you say, around the world, and it's really a divergence or a coming together, sorry, of the interests of myself and my two brothers who are behind it, and some of our other contributors, which is about marrying design and illustration and art with football, which we're seeing more and more online and with blogs and Twitter accounts, and no more so than with this World Cup.
One of the things that seems to be on the rise, James, is world football magazines and online world football websites. You know, I've had discussions with several journalists from around the world. Most recently, a guy called Erasmo Hernandez, he set up a Venezuelan soccer site, and now they've all of a sudden they're featured everything in South America. You know, they try to cover it all. Is it fair to say that this is how these type of sites like Pogmagol start out? They start covering local and Irish soccer or local football in their own country, and all of a sudden they realise there's a much greater reach, and they all eventually become world soccer publications.
Well, it's certainly possible, because you can be in your bedroom in Dublin and you can be tweeting to the world, Dave. So, like, that distance and that barrier is no longer there. So it's definitely potential for that. In our own case, we specifically started out saying we wouldn't be a news site on the Irish team, because there are countless other outlets where you can go to get that kind of information. And firstly, we didn't want to do it, but also there was no point doing it to go up against sites and organizations with bigger resources. So we carved out our own niche, which was there isn't really a blogging culture in Ireland. It is increasing more and more, but we took our little part of the market to engage with Irish football followers who, when it comes down to it, Dave, really, you can categorize the interest of the Irish football fan, which is the Irish national team, probably a team in England. They'll have an interest in the world game, the likes of Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, PSG. Beyond that, you'll have people with an interest in maybe South American football, Asian football, Australian football, where Irish people are, MLS. So there's a way to tap into all those people. But more than that, what we've found, since we really kind of indulge in our love of the artistic side and the illustration side, is that people want to engage in that. They're hugely talented illustrators, artists around the world, putting their love of football into their work. Just a quick example is the Brazil national team playing at the World Cup. You may have seen the pictures, has been completely transformed. A full Boeing, whatever it is, jet, has been completely painted by two Brazilian graffiti artists. And that kind of stuff is now being put out across the world for people to see. Whereas before it would have been, okay, this is the Brazil national team are going to the World Cup. Now there's a whole thing about the actual plane they're traveling in, Dave, what it looks like and who designed that behind it. So it's just opened up all manner of avenues for what people are interested in, allied to their love of football.
I love that whole attitude, James. The whole, we're going to take a story, but we're going to look at the different side to a story and expand on that. It's kind of like the stuff Philip O'Connor does, where he covers a story for Reuters from a political side rather than just the result of the match and how a certain player played and that. I have to ask you, you touched on it and about the Irish soccer, and you were covering Irish soccer, and you know, you look to how it spreads. You know, there's a couple of Irish players playing in the MLS and Australia and stuff like that, and you tend to cover that. But for bloggers and for people that start off writing for internet publications, is it primarily too small to be just covered on, say, from an Irish point of view, just Irish football and Irish international football, you know, and maybe League of Ireland stuff and that? Is your market, if you want to be successful at this, which is certainly the road you guys are on, do you have to expand? Do you feel that you had no choice?
Not necessarily. It's really down to the individual. Like, there are people, if you want to take something like extratime.ie, Dave, which is an absolutely superb website dedicated to League of Ireland coverage. And in fact, nobody would disagree with me if I said it's better than any official account out there. And that's, from what I understand, it's all volunteers. Volunteers at every League of Ireland ground, photographers each weekend. And something like that has built up a following, and it's superb output. And that's the road they wanted to go down. We initially started out, we always tried to cover what we thought people were interested in, because we were interested in it, like what I touched on before, the Premier League, the Irish players in the Premier League, the national team. But it's just gradually expanded to really indulge in our own personal interests. Mine has always been about writing, but as you say, those kind of the stories behind the stories, the stories behind the goal score or the result or the history leading up to the match and this kind of thing. My brother Key, who is our main graphic designer, originally studied animation, and he's brought that kind of artistic eye to combining it with his career now as a graphic designer, but applying it to football. So it's really about indulging your own passion, because what I've always been told is that if you write about something you would want to read about, others will too.
Yeah, that's
the ethos behind what we've been doing.
Yeah, it reminds me of a quote that Robin Williams gave in the film Mrs. Doubtfire, when he was putting forward his idea for a kids show to the TV producer, and he said, "If it's something you'd enjoy, they'd enjoy." And you can never go wrong with that. There's no doubt about that.
That's it, Dave. And maybe at the start, because we started out trying to be funny, a humorous website, which, you know, we were able to indulge our own sense of humor. And God knows, following the Irish team over the last few years, you needed a sense of humor. But we had contributors. Some of the guys were really, they were really funny guys who put comedic writing about the Irish team, and it got a great response. But we found that trying to be funny for the sake of it, Dave, just doesn't work. And one man's humor just isn't found funny by other people. And really, you have to be true to yourself and indulge your own passion, your own interest, and put that out there. And we've found, especially since creating the magazine, that particularly in the artists and design community worldwide, the response has been really phenomenal. The goodwill we've had, because we've tried to create something that's visually unique, combining illustrations, photography with what we think is great writing with interesting articles. And we've just had a great response to it.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was going to ask you, James. We talked about the fantastic illustrations and the artistic work that you actually have in the magazine. It really is fantastic. It's something a little bit different. It's combining the talents of art with the great writing and the actual good stories that go on board. You were saying before that a lot of the artists, they were more than happy to get on board when they found out you guys were Irish. Why do you think that was? Did they feel that, well, they're passionate about their work, they're going to be working with Irish people who were passionate too?
I think that's it, the nail on the head. But also, we can't discount that people just love the Irish all around the world, Dave. Like, I've seen it in my own travels, and no more so when we all went to Poland for the Euros, that people just love our attitude and our passion, particularly for football. So an example was Gabriel Uchida, who we feature, is a Brazilian photojournalist who documents supporters and hooligans in his native country. And the guy couldn't have been more willing to provide us with his images. His email was that he was proud to be showcased in an Irish magazine. And this is, you know, we're just tapped into the goodwill of people. As I said, that kind of blogging culture and community has always been about helping each other out, networking, if you like, but more than that is speaking and developing relationships who have the same passion as you do. Just like, for an example, on blogging, Dave, like, you can literally create a blog about anything. I've come across one which is documenting football ground floodlights around the world, which sounds tedious, and yet if you're to visit it, there's something like 800 different floodlight pictures from grounds around the world, and it's beautiful, Dave. It's so interesting. In theory, it should be boring, but to visit it, it isn't. It's something really interesting and brings a new side to football, and as I said, people indulging in their interests.
When we had Tony O'Donoghue on the Why Big Football show, James, and Miguel Delaney, they both spoke about one of the reasons for the League of Ireland not looking the spectacle that it should do is the fact that the pitches weren't fully illuminated. You know, they had this kind of dull, dreary kind of lampshaded on them. Whereas, say, in parts of Spain, when, you know, their life is the night, we'll say, to be overly romantic, the pitches, they just seem to be so bright. I mean, I know you can say about floodlights in Spain, if you're looking at Real Madrid, they're going to have a bright pitch. It's fabulous. But there is a difference there. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, and a big thing about when League of Ireland football started to be televised was that even a little thing about what side of the ground you put the cameras on, Dave, because you know and I know that the football grounds in Ireland aren't exactly these cathedrals of football we see around the world. So, like, it's about optics, to use a Fine Gael expression. God, I didn't want to use that. but you know what I mean is that, you know, you put the camera at Dalymount looking into that Jodie stand that's full of people, not to the other side, which has half a terrace and then cars. It's about perception, you know, and that's something that League of Ireland still has to learn about. But even if you talk about the recent Irish games, which have had such poor attendances, you're talking about maybe we should close the upper tiers of the stand to congregate people in the lower sections to create atmosphere.
The GAA are fantastic for that, James.
Yeah, but like there's thought process behind that, Dave, and really that's what people have to learn is about professionalism and getting an interest in your product.
Yeah, I agree with you there. A quick point I want to go back to you, James, is something you raised about, you know, young bloggers, up and coming bloggers as well that have been getting involved with you guys. And, you know, people have the interest and they can write about what they're interested in. However, the love that you say you've received from people around the world, maybe you didn't quite receive that from other people in Ireland, because Ireland is such a saturated market. Would your advice for young people to be try and take up things out that are outside of Ireland and they'll have a good reaction from people because of their Irish nationality?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair point. I think also Ireland is a small market that if you can tap into, we've talked about how the Premier League is this giant beside us. If you can tap into that market, if you're going to talk about football, and absolutely do it. As I said before, talking about Australian football, we've had a guest on the Why Big show before who writes about the Australian League, and I think you said he's based in a shed in Dublin. Is that right?
That's right. He does the programmes for Perth Glory. Gareth Morgan.
Gareth, yes.
He filled us in all about the Irish players playing abroad in Australia and the type of league and how it's developing and that kind of thing. And yeah, he does it all from a shed. He calls himself a John Walters workhorse type journalist.
Well, that's it. So you don't have to be in that country to talk about that football. So you can really indulge what you're interested in. And now with the advent of social media, but more so on any given weekend, you can watch football matches from MLS to South America to A-League in Australia, Bundesliga. You know, we're no longer just restricted to Premier League football on our doorstep, and you can really indulge in what you're interested in and reach that target market. My advice to anybody, and what we found from day one when we started, was to really be nice to people, Dave, and cooperate with people and create relationships with them where there's a bit of give and take, where you will help them, even things like saying we'll credit your account if we use your piece, or we'll put links in, and you just foster a relationship of cooperation, and that's where the goodwill has come from. And as I said, we've been bowled over by who we've had help from, but not just up and coming, but established people. Like we've had the Schalke 04 club in Germany was able to send us images, Adidas were able to send us images, New York Cosmos sent us material, Vasava, which is a design agency in Barcelona, who designed the numbering and lettering on Barcelona's shirts, they were more than happy to help us. So really, you know, if you're nice to people, it should come back on you tenfold, as they say.
With a bit of luck, it will. At the same time, you're given a platform for people, up-and-coming artists as well, to display their work and good writers and that kind of thing. And that's something, no doubt, that you've had a lot of success from. Good articles that might not necessarily have the platform to get out there for people to read.
Yeah, and some of what we've produced both in the magazine and on the site has been published elsewhere, but perhaps to a smaller market. And really, we've come across it and said, I really like this article and I think our followers would too. Would you mind if we republished it? And that's kind of where it started from. So we have a writer based in England, Leith Youssef is his name, who has a superb article on Enzo Schifo, the Belgian, and a goal he scored at the 1990 World Cup. But he also has another article in the magazine where he follows Johnny Phillips of Sky Sports. So for 2 days he shadowed Johnny going up and down the grounds of England and based at Sky Sports Studios in London himself. So, and Leith has gone on to write for the Arsenal Programme magazine. He's currently working with the Evening Standard paper in London. So, you know, it's about people getting their work out there. And I was always told to improve your writing, it sounds stupid, Dave, was to just write, continually write and improve your craft no matter what you're writing about. And that would be my advice to anyone who wants to get into the game, is write about everything and anything. But really what I found is when you indulge what you really are passionate about is when your best writing comes to the fore.
What about video blogs, James? Because we've seen the rise and rise of small clips, vines, all sorts of things, and now people putting themselves in front of a camera, uploading it to YouTube, putting it out on their site. A lot of people don't like reading long text, but if there's short, snappy videos, they'll certainly enjoy that. They seem to, particularly on Facebook as well, when you upload a video to Facebook, it gets a lot more reach and coverage than, say, an article or a link that you're posting.
Yep, there's a science behind it, Dave. There's also about what times you should post your, you put out your tweets, what times you should put out your posts to have maximum reach. You're right, a picture is stronger than an article or a link. A video will be stronger than an image sometimes. It'll, if you're talking about things going viral, then as you say, a Vine, which often is a guy sat in front of his TV with his mobile phone camera recording a goal, and you can get it quicker, you can see a goal quicker on a Vine on Twitter than you will waiting for an established news outlet to put it out. But there's also rights issues with that as well, Dave, but if you're talking about the kind of gray area of Twitter, once a Vine is out, it can be taken down later, but everybody can see the goal. So yes, you know, the whole advent of social media, Twitter, Facebook, has opened up to self-publishers, if you like. Our decision with the magazine was to take a little bit of step back to revert to a print edition. We, of course, were established online as a website, but we took a different decision to put out something in print because we felt it would be a return to something unique, really. And our magazine, while we say magazine, it's really a newspaper, Dave. It's on newsprint paper. It looks like a paper. It feels like a paper. But when you open it up, there's this kind of splash of color. And what we tried to do, as I said, is ally really interesting graphic design and illustration with writing to create something we think is quite special. So we took that different approach to go back to print. And we've found, if you want to talk about self-publishing a print, that maybe a reluctance amongst advertisers to embrace print because they think it's dead and that online is the only way to go. But no, if you really want to put it out there and you can get the results and you can get the exposure if you're prepared to put the work in.
Because there's so many situations where people will want to pick up something and read it. And what's really great is the fact that you guys have so many feature articles. They're articles that's not going to go out of date. Whereas, you know, when you pick up a normal newspaper every day, if it's the day before, if it's the previous day's paper, forget about it. You know the result. You know what happened in the match. It doesn't matter. But on this, it's a feature article about it. You can read about other stories. And that's key when it comes to a magazine like what you guys are doing.
Yeah, that was entirely intentional, that the articles would be timeless, if you like. That. And I think based on Key's design, my brother, that it's also something, okay, it's a newspaper, but we think you wouldn't throw it away when you're finished with it, that this is something you might like to collect, and hopefully if there's future editions, which we 100% intend there to be, that you would build these up like the, those publications, football publications that have become more and more prevalent in the market now, like Howler, 8x8 in America, the Green Soccer Journal, the Blizzard, which is kind of a forum for established football journalists. But it's something that's, they're beautiful pieces of art, really, Dave, that you don't want to throw away, you want to keep. And ours was very much based along that line, that the articles would be in the main timeless, that you could pick up and read again in 6 months' time. And that there were a number of factors behind that, not least the time it would take to put out the magazine and the hurdles we had to overcome with that, but also for those very reasons that we didn't want it to become dated. And we wanted those stories that, as you say, were more featured, that you could invest a bit more time and that the writers, I guess, invested a bit more love in.
Absolutely. It sounds terrific, James, altogether. Now, you yourself, you're quite a travelled man. You've been around Brazil and, you know, you've been through the UK, Europe and across the world, really. And has that helped you gain a greater understanding of what people like to read about and the different unique stories that you've been able to discover?
I think it is. I think as we've kind of said, the world has become a smaller place, but that means in a sense we're opened up to these new cultures, and in a football sense we can get to those stories really that we probably wouldn't have heard before. So just to go back to the magazine again, that was a story about how the Brazil team came to wear the yellow jersey, which I've seen it a little bit in the build up to this World Cup, but it's a fascinating story, Dave, about it was an 18-year-old graphic designer in the city of Pelotas near the border with Uruguay who submitted this drawing to a national newspaper after Brazil had been beaten in the 1950 World Cup final. So up to that point, Brazil wore, I think it was a white shirt with a blue collar, but they ran this competition that they wanted something that was more nationalistic, that would reflect the national flag. And this 18-year-old design was picked. And look at that shirt now. It's one of the most famous sports items in the world, really. And as I wrote in the article, it's as much a symbol of Brazil as perhaps the statue of Christ the Redeemer in Rio, which we've been seeing for the last fortnight. But nothing says Brazil to me more than the yellow shirt of the football team.
Indeed, and Nike will be very happy to hear you echo those words, no doubt about it.
Well, just a point on that is, as we're talking about blogging and that whole realm, if you like, that I found this World Cup in particular, and I think it's only going to continue with future tournaments, has been a battle of marketing and PR. And so a lot of bloggers are getting exposure and artists are getting exposure. But to talk about the big giants of Nike and Adidas, there's been a real concerted effort on their part in the build up to this tournament to out Brazilify each other, if you like, with the release of jerseys. And lots of national teams have a Brazil inspired kit, like the German away kit, as we all know, is green, but for this tournament it's red and black stripes, which is based on the Flamengo club in Rio. So like, there's thought process behind all of this, and the biggest companies in the world have been putting resources into this. You saw that amazing Nike advert of the animation of Ronaldo and Ibrahimovic and Wayne Rooney going to Brazil. Like, there's years of thought goes into this, but it's not some guy in a suit at Nike. They're hiring artists and other people who have this interest, designers who are marrying their love of art and putting their craft into the sport that we all love.
Indeed, the football boots as well has been quite interesting, James, because I've seen a lot of the players wearing the same type of design, and then some of the others are wearing similar ones as well. It's almost like, as you said, that battle is going on off the field as well as on the field.
Oh yeah, but I think it was every week almost Adidas were releasing a new line of boots. We have an article on the Copa Mundial, which most people will be familiar with, that kind of Franz Beckenbauer black and white design. But in the lead up to this World Cup, Adidas released an all-white version. A couple of months later, they released a Samba range, which was the same boot, but in these extreme flamboyant colours. And after that, there was kind of they had different versions of the Predator boot. And, you know, like, this is all intentional, Dave. They realised that this tournament is coming up, and a lot of thought and a lot of planning goes into it. And as I said, they're engaging with artists and designers when it comes to this.
It's incredible stuff. Just before I let you go, James, I know you've been in the UK, you're the Irishman living in the UK for a while, but you've recently relocated to Germany. And has that expanded your horizons, or how do you feel? How's it going?
Oh yeah, I've been here about 5 weeks now, Dave. I've taken up a role as a social media manager with Bundesliga, so I'm really getting to throw myself into German football, which is a great time to do it, not so much this year, but in recent years they've been dominating in Europe, and as we've said before, their national team's not doing too bad at all. So it's a great time to be here. It's a great opportunity. I'm learning the German way of life. And thankfully, when the Euros qualifiers come around, we have Ireland coming to town. Not in my town of Hamburg, but they'll be nearby, and I'll certainly be trying to get to it.
Indeed, and I have to ask you about, you mentioned the German way of life there. if you were to go back to Ireland, would it be? Would you be as frustrated as a madman, really, with what goes on in Ireland? Because I know the Germans, they're very efficient. I was getting a train before from Frankfurt, and I think it was running 30 seconds late, and I counted about five German men looking at their watches.
Stuff certainly works here, Dave, so I've learned that, but... frustrated, I don't know, you'll always love Ireland, won't you? But what I would say to come back to bring it back to football, which we always like to do, is that I don't think I've found any country, and I've watched World Cup games now with Brazilians, Americans, English, Germans. I don't think they're half as intense as we are, Dave. And I only wish we were in this one. Like, the Germans just expect to win. And I think it's that kind of GAA mentality that you win your personal battles, that a long ball, if Richard Dunn puts his head on a long ball and puts it into row Z, the crowd erupts. And no other country does that, Dave, because we fight for every ball, I guess because we have to. But I definitely miss that intensity that Irish fans bring to football.
Yeah, everything's a little personal battle. With that, James Carew, thanks for joining us. We wish you the very best of luck with a terrific magazine, Pog McGoal, going forward. And I look forward to chatting to you on the Why Big Football Show in the coming weeks.
That's great. Thank you, Dave.
This is Freak.
Some great stuff there by James Carew. Now, we can't go without mentioning League of Ireland football, and the League of Ireland champions are going to travel to Poland in the Champions League, while Derry must make the short trip to Wales in the Europa League. The European draws has been done for the Irish clubs. Some very interesting ties indeed. St. Patrick's Athletic will travel to Legia Warsaw. A cracking encounter in store. Very difficult for Pats, mind you. Cliftonville, by the way, will take on Brechny VSC. That's the Champions League second qualifying rounds for the League of Ireland teams there. In the Europa League first qualifying round, Derry City will take on Aberystwyth Town. Sligo Rovers will travel to FK Banga. Dundalk will travel to AS Jeunesse Eshk. While Glenavon up north will take on FH. Linfield will take on B36. And Crusaders will take on FK Ekranis. No doubt very difficult games, but it gives us a chance to see how the Irish clubs will do in Europe, and we're wishing all of them the very best of luck, because no doubt tough ties going up, but what they might have in their locker is the fact that they've been playing summer soccer competitive games during the summer months, which can help the Irish teams, which we've seen in previous years. No doubt a lot of teams will want to follow in the footsteps of Shamrock Rovers in that memorable Europa League group stage qualifying. Now, I know the World Cup is taking very much the centre stage, but if you do fancy getting down to some League of Ireland games, you can check it out. On Friday, we've got Bowes taking on Athlone Town. Athlone Town finally getting some points on the board. That match is on Friday. Cork City host Limerick. Drogheda United take on Sligo Rovers. St. Patrick's Athletic host Bray Wanderers. UCD take on Shamrock Rovers. And Derry City take on Dundalk. Those games are all kicking off at 7:45. So if you can get down to them, they're pretty good indeed. Also on Friday in the First Division, Galway FC take on Longford Town, 7:45 kickoff there. Finn Harps take on Waterford United, and Shelburne take on Wexford Utes. Those are at 8 o'clock on Friday. And on Saturday, Cove Ramblers will host Shamrock Rovers Bees at 7:45. Well, I'm afraid I'm out of time here on the Why Big Football Show. My thanks to all our guests. It's been a great show. I hope to have the pleasure of your company at the same time next week. From myself, Dave O'Grady, have a very good sporting week. Enjoy the World Cup, and if you can, get down to some League of Ireland games. Chat to you soon.